China on the final frontier, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. So much to talk about today, including a long and fascinating conversation with space journalist Andrew Jones. I don't know anyone outside China who knows more about what the Middle Kingdom is doing and plans to do in space. I think you'll be impressed. Crew Dragon is still docked with the International Space Station as we complete this episode. We'll talk with Jason Davis about this big step toward astronauts once again riding U.S. spacecraft into orbit, along with more big news from Jason. And Bruce Betts will get politely dressed down for the wording of the space trivia contest question that will resolve this week. His accuser is someone who ought to know. We begin delightfully with senior editor Emily Lakdawalla. Emily, a couple of things for us to cover in this brief segment. And I want to start with the first line in your blog post from March 1st. Mars could have given us a break, but it didn't. What are you about here?
It's the same old story, isn't it? Yeah. So InSight landed in a spot on Mars that looked absolutely perfect for the mole. It landed inside this sandy hollow, which seems like a bowl full of sand. It should be absolutely perfect for it to be able to put this little heat probe in down about 3 or 5 meters in order to measure the rate at which heat propagates through the soil and the rate at which the heat is emanating from Mars's interior. Well, it turns out Mars had other ideas. There appears to have been a rock buried underneath where they placed the mole. And, you know, the team anticipated this, and their design is supposed to be able to push aside rocks that are small or kind of wiggle around larger rocks. But it seems to be having some pretty serious problems actually getting in place. And there was an update on Twitter this morning that they're actually going to stop and reassess the situation for a couple of weeks.
Wow. Well, to paraphrase, or with apologies to Robert Heinlein, we know Mars is a harsh mistress. Do they have alternatives? Does this mean that the mole, which I suppose is already dug deeper than anything ever has before on Mars, that it might be completely stymied?
Well, it might be, but there's definitely no reason to give up yet. Engineers are resourceful. I'm sure they will be trying lots of things, and hopefully one of the things that they try will get them past whatever obstruction this is, and they'll still get that mole buried deeply enough to do some good science with it. They actually don't have to get all the way to 5 meters. They don't even have to get all the way to 3 meters. As long as they can bury the probe beneath the surface to some distance, like even a meter, would be really great. But they do have to get it completely buried, and right now the top of the mole is still protruding from the surface. So that's no good.
All right, let's move way farther out into the Kuiper Belt, where there has been an interesting scientific conclusion from data gathered by New Horizons.
Yeah, so New Horizons observed both Pluto and Charon and then passed by MU69. And all of those bodies don't have very many craters on it. They have fewer craters than anticipated. That leads to the conclusion that there are fewer impactors out there than scientists thought. Fewer small bodies in the Kuiper Belt wandering around to cause impacts, impact craters. They think that the smaller bodies in the Kuiper Belt, rather than smashing into and disrupting each other, actually smashed and squished together, flomped together. And that term flomp is actually, it actually appears in a lunar and planetary science conference abstract at the meeting I'll be attending in a week or two. Flomping and blorping are two new terms in Kuiper Belt science that I'll be excited to tell you more about after I see those presentations.
Great new technical terms. I hope we can get one of those patented summary reports from you on all the great stuff you'll be hearing at LPSC.
You definitely will.
Thank you, Emily. She is our senior editor at the Planetary Society, our planetary evangelist. That's Emily Lakdawalla. Let's keep it within the family now and go to the Planetary Society's digital editor, Jason Davis. Jason, welcome back. As you know, when I asked you to come back on the show for a quick update about Crew Dragon, we didn't know that we would be getting this absolutely jaw-dropping. I mean, my mouth really was hanging open when I saw what has now been returned from Hayabusa 2, and which you wrote about just this morning as we speak on March 5th. People can see it at planetary.org. Tell us about this video.
Yeah, so we knew Hayabusa 2 touched down successfully on Ryugu. What we didn't know is what all that looked like. And Japan's Space Agency was kind of holding out on us a little bit. They held back some cool pictures from one of the cameras on the side of the spacecraft that was there to photograph, take still images in succession as the spacecraft was going down and touches the surface. They finally had a press briefing. You know, it's almost been 2 weeks after the touchdown, and they released that video, and it's pretty much exceeded all expectations of how cool that would be. Yeah. The sample horn sticking down from the bottom of the spacecraft touches the surface. And when it does, the bullet fires inside the horn to collect the sample. Material from the asteroid just sprays everywhere. It's like it created this giant cloud of debris in the middle of space. It's super cool to watch.
New human asteroids. That's what we want. Yeah. Human-created asteroids. More debris in space.
Yeah.
Let's bring it much closer to home, but also very impressive images and video. And that, of course, is Crew Dragon. How's it going?
Yeah, so Crew Dragon is now docked at the International Space Station. It got up there this weekend. Everything went kind of according to plan. To recap quickly, this is SpaceX's Dragon spacecraft that will actually carry humans. So it's got seats in it. It had a mannequin in it in a SpaceX spacesuit named Ripley, which is pretty cool. A little nod to the Alien movies. Yeah, it got up there. This is its uncrewed test flight. It got up there, docked successfully without much of a hitch at all. And it's staying on station for about a week and is going to come back down on Friday morning. So far, so good for SpaceX and Crew Dragon.
This is good news as we look toward the next Crew Dragon with those two NASA astronauts in it.
Yeah, they have been really visible throughout this whole process, watching the launch. And as they should be, they're going to be riding on one of these things later this year. And as far as we know, that is still scheduled to happen no earlier than summer, but people are predicting the launch will slip a little bit, but predictions still say this year we'll see astronauts fly from Florida for the first time since the shuttle program on one of these. So it's a pretty exciting time for NASA.
Two very exciting updates. Jason, as always, thank you very much.
Thanks, Matt.
Jason Davis is our digital editor and our embedded reporter with LightSail 2, which we will continue to talk with him about. I'll be right back with journalist and Chinese space program expert Andrew Jones. This is Planetary Radio.
Hey, this is Casey Dreyer, the chief advocate here at the Planetary Society. As you probably know, Congress is back in session. It is a brand new Congress. Welcome to the 116th session. And it is the perfect time to write them and tell them that space is really important, NASA funding is important, and it should be a priority. We made this really easy for you. Just go to planetary.org/advocacy. We have a form there, planetary.org/advocacy. Thanks.
Hello, I'm Robert Picardo, Planetary Society board member and now the host of the Society's Planetary Post video newsletter. There's a new edition every month. We've already gone behind the scenes at JPL, partied at Yuri's Night, and visited with CEO Bill Nye. We've also got the month's top headlines from around the solar system. You can sign up at planetary.org/connect. When you do, you'll be among the first to see each new show. I hope you'll join us.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. If you've recently read news about China's accomplishments in space, you may know our guest. Space journalist Andrew Jones has written for others, but we hope he now thinks of the Planetary Society as his online home. His real-world home is Finland, where he lives with his young family. And that's where I reached him not long ago for a long-overdue review of the ambitious efforts underway by the nation with our planet's second-biggest economy. With so much to cover this week, I can only give you a taste of my conversation with Andrew here. Check out the podcast version of this episode at planetary.org/radio for the complete interview. You'll hear even more evidence that China plans to be in the forefront of exploration and possibly more. Have you developed some personal contacts who are knowledgeable about the program? I mean, you don't need to identify them here, but are some of them, does some of them prefer to remain unnamed, incognito?
Oh, I couldn't possibly say, Matt. No, I mean, if you look at the science side of the Chinese space program, then you would find that there's a tendency for some people to be more open than they would be, say, on the more national security side of things, where they just really can't talk and it's just best if they don't. So, yeah, it's possible to make contacts, but a lot of the time it will just be something which can help your understanding off the record rather than something that you can report.
Let's talk about what's in the news, of course. I guess we have to start with that exciting mission that is right now exploring the far side of the moon, which is a pretty impressive effort. Tell us, what's the current status of Chang'e 4?
And so the U-2 rover is in a standby state for its so-called noon nap, because the potential issues from high direct solar radiation and also maybe vision issues related to the sun being high in the sky over the landing site, that's going to wake up again, I think, on March 10 and then go back into hibernation for its third lunar night on March 13. In the meantime, the lander will be carrying out its science objectives. I think it was yesterday that we got new images from the rover, which show a close-up view of some rocks which it came across on its path towards the northeast from the landing site. The scientists at the Chinese Academy of Sciences are promising updates on what they're finding regarding the origin and composition of these rocks. So that's something to look forward to. But we're not really getting many regular updates, and it's a bit disappointing in a way that we're not seeing so many images. And if you remember the Chang'e 3 mission, there was this huge dump of fantastic high-resolution images from Mare Imbrium on the near side, which I think the Planetary Society made them available. You took them from the Chinese site and hosted them on the Planetary Society website, and that proved to be very popular. So we might have to wait a while before these new images from the far side are released en masse for the public to see.
Another of your blog posts, which we'll put a link to on this week's show page, people can reach from planetary.org/radio. You posted this on January 23rd, and here is, scrolling down a bit, this timeline, which traces exactly what you have been talking about. What is next here? There's a Chang'e 6 and an HX1, both of which, at least on this timeline, are listed as happening next year, 2020.
So the next stage for the lunar exploration would be to target the South Pole. So that would be 2 to 3 missions, or depending on whose presentation you're reading, 3 to 4 missions by around 2030. Chang'e 6, which would be the backup to Chang'e 5, that would be a sample return mission, which would then head for the lunar South Pole. Following this, they would send Chang'e 7 also to the lunar South Pole. And this will be based on the Chang'e 5 and Chang'e 6 lander. But this will consist of 5 parts. So they'll again have a relay satellite, and this will probably be a new relay satellite with new capabilities. It would also have, as well as the lander, it would have a rover and also what they're describing as flyby robots. My understanding is that this would be kind of a one-time shot where they could say if they land at one of the areas which could be considered the peaks of eternal light, where you have almost constant solar illumination, they would also be interested then in the permanently shadowed areas where there may be water ice. So you would use this flyby robot to then go and analyze these areas for water and volatiles.
Of course, the presence of that water, which is now very nearly confirmed, I think most scientists believe it's assuredly in these permanently shaded areas, that has been sort of a lunar holy grail for many, many years.
Absolutely. So these goals which they're laying out aren't exactly new. I think that the kind of international scientific community has laid these out as being of tremendous importance for quite some years now. It's not something new that China's wanting to do, but the fact is that they could actually be the first or among the first to do this. And following the Chang'e 7 mission, this would be followed up by Chang'e 8, which would again have science objectives such as carrying spectrometers and neutron and gamma ray detectors and so on. But also they would be looking then to test 3D printing in lunar gravity, also in-situ resource utilization tests. Again, looking forward to the next step with the idea of establishing what they're calling an international research base on the moon, which sounds a bit like the ESA moon village.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to say, which is something that Jan Werner, the head of ESA, the European Space Agency, has been talking about for several years now. You include one of their artist renderings of this research base. It is very, very impressive.
Well, it's certainly ambitious. I think to get this kind of infrastructure up to the moon, this again requires new launch vehicles. So China's working on something called the Long March 9, which would be something like 100 meters tall, 10 meter diameter, plus what are effectively four Long March 5 rockets strapped on. So this would be something in the class of the Saturn V or the SLS. They would need to get that working to make this happen, which in itself is a very challenging and ambitious project. They're making clear that this is the goal that they have. So they're calling it international. So the base would be modular and would be standardized so that other nations could come and get involved in this project or cooperate to some extent. But the one thing I would like to point out, China likes to talk a lot about international cooperation. A lot of the news reports highlight how Chang'e 4 has four international payloads and how they're open to working with European Space Agency and so on. But I don't get any indication, either with the Chinese space station, which could be launching the first module as soon as next year, and with this research base, which they would plan, I don't get the impression that they want cooperation so that another country would be involved in the critical pathway of anything that they're doing. So they can come and add on to what's going on, or they can launch experiments alongside. But it's not like that you would have with the International Space Station, where you have Canada, or that you have Europe providing the service module for the Orion capsule, for example. I mean, those place countries in an absolutely crucial role within these projects. But with China, I think that they want to maintain control themselves as far as they can.
Before we wrap up, take us out beyond the moon, because China has plans for the rest of the solar system as well.
So you referenced this deep space exploration roadmap, which was posted in the blog. And this came from a presentation to the United Nations, to one of the space congresses in Austria. What we can expect is next year, if this Long March 5 rocket is operational again after its July return to flight, it will launch the Chang'e 5 mission, of course, but then it will be used next July or August for launching China's first independent interplanetary mission, which would be to Mars. And that is rather ambitious for a first-time attempt, because the Mars mission will include an orbiter and a rover in one go. So they have the challenges of executing an interplanetary mission for the first time, entering Mars orbit, which is no easy feat by itself, but then going through entry, descent, and landing and pulling that off.
Yes, we have learned, of course, that that is one of the hardest things to do in space.
Well, indeed, NASA's the only one that's managed to do it. So it's going to be interesting next year. Well, in early 2021, when we have all those missions from ESA and Russia and United Arab Emirates as well, I believe. So that would be very interesting to see. China, as part of a Mars exploration package, which they have, they would look to follow that up with, again, an extremely ambitious mission, which would be a Mars sample return. That would be launching around 2028 or 2030. That depends on this Long March 9 super heavy lift rocket. Beyond that, they have their eyes on a Jupiter mission, which from the early design discussions that I'm aware of, this would be an orbiter which would target a particular moon, but also have general science goals to analyze the Jupiter system. In between there, they're actually developing some concepts for asteroid missions. So for a long time, they had one which would involve flybys and even landing on two or three asteroids in one shot. But there's a new proposal out now which hasn't been approved, but this would travel to a near-Earth asteroid followed by returning, leaving samples, and then using a gravity assist to head off to Mars for another gravity assist to head to a main belt comet.
Wow.
So similar to the Rosetta mission. It's a tremendously exciting mission again. And that mission was, I think they were using a provisional name of Zheng He, who was a eunuch admiral from the 14th century, known for his exploration of the Indian Ocean and the Horn of Africa and so on.
I've read about him. This is the guy with those ships that dwarfed the European caravels of the time, right? A very impressive explorer during that great period of exploration for China.
Absolutely. And that's a very interesting name. I don't know if that will be adopted, but it got me to thinking that those ships and the exploration that they carried out, they were ended because they were seen as being very expensive, a big drain on resources. It's kind of interesting to think what they could have achieved if they had gone on. I mean, imagine how history would be different if they had, say, discovered America.
Yes.
Enormous fleet.
It certainly sounds like China is going to be giving you plenty to keep you very busy for years to come.
Indeed. As we can see, this is all very ambitious, but the challenges are going to be very large regarding funding, regarding technology and engineering. So it's going to be very interesting to follow in the next few years to see how they get along and also what we can learn from the solar system as all of this unfolds.
Andrew, again, thank you very much for this, for taking us through the Chinese space program.
Thanks, Matt. Great to talk to you.
That's Andrew Jones. He reports on the Chinese space program, largely for the Planetary Society. He is a Finland-based journalist, and you can follow him on Twitter. He's at AJ_FI. It is time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. And we have the chief scientist of the Planetary Society to guide us through that. It's Bruce Betts. Welcome back.
Hello.
All right. I don't have anything clever, but we have something very interesting to say about the contest later. So go ahead. Get us started toward that point.
All right. Pre-dawn sky party planets, three of them. Pre-dawn east, going from super bright Venus, low in the pre-dawn east. Go to the upper right, you'll see yellowish Saturn, much dimmer, and then bright Jupiter to the upper right of that, making a lovely kind of line going on in the pre-dawn. And Mars still hanging out in the evening west, looking still pretty dim, but reddish and like a kind of bright star. We move on to this week in space history, 1969, the first solo flight of the lunar module on Apollo 9. We talked about its launch last week, but now we have the anniversary of it floating free. And there's actually a nice Apollo 9 page on our website now if people are interested in getting some more information. And then 2006, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter arrived in orbit around Mars and has been working great ever since. In 2015, Dawn went into orbit around Ceres.
And that will come up again. I want to mention, because this is kind of a new thing on our site, and I think it's working really well. If you go to planetary.org and you have the menu, just under Explore, go to Space Missions in that drop-down menu, and you will see trending, hashtag trending missions. That's where you'll find a lot of stuff that's trending. It's pretty exciting. I really like this new approach on our website to missions.
Yeah, we're building out all sorts of good evergreen pages, basically, with useful information. We move on to Random Space Band.
Okay, I thought that was funny. Go ahead.
Yay! Very approximately, interstellar space, between the stars and our galaxy, has about one hydrogen atom per cubic centimeter.
Wow. Be hard to start an explosion if you had maybe that and two oxygen. Never mind.
Yes, this is why interstellar space does not burst into flames on a regular basis.
I did see a science fiction movie about that that was made into a TV show a long time ago. I think, anyway, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. The sky's on fire.
All right, moving along. I asked you, of the five dwarf planets currently classified as dwarf planets, which is the only one that does not have at least one moon? How'd we do, Matt?
Let me first read this suggested correction to the contest from an interested listener who says, I presume your question was meant to be, of the five known dwarf planets, which are the only four not known to have an artificial moon? It was an understandable slip of the tongue on your part, so you needn't feel embarrassed. Signed, the chief engineer and mission director of the Dawn mission, Mark Raymond.
Dawn, that's no moon. No, okay, I could see you could argue it's an artificial moon or an artificial satellite, and it is in orbit around Ceres. But yes, I was looking for natural moons, natural satellites, but we'll take either.
And Mark would be proud, or I hope we'll be proud to hear that a lot of other people said, yeah, it's Ceres unless you count that little emissary from Earth. Here's our winner, Frank Eisenach, a first-time winner from Germany, one of many listeners we have there, who indeed said it is Ceres or Betelgeuse, so to speak. Betelgeuse, that's a fictional term out of that whole series of books and now, of course, the TV series, The Expanse, which I was turned on to by listeners, and man, is it good, and I cannot wait for it to come back. It's gotten picked up from the Sci-Fi Channel by Netflix, and I think it's coming back this summer. Anyway, somebody out there knows and will tell us.
Undoubtedly, someone out there knows.
Frank, congratulations. You've gotten yourself a Planetary Society kick asteroid, rubber asteroid, and a 200-point iTelescope.net astronomy account. We're ready for your new contest.
We're going to talk Hayabusa 2 that just recently did its first sampling of another asteroid, Ryugu. And we've got a great article by Jason Davis about that on our website. What are the Hayabusa 2, what are its 5-gram bullets used in surface sampling? What are they made of? This is the surface sampling like they just did, where they shoot the surface with a comparatively low-speed bullet and then catch stuff that comes off. This is not to be confused with when they do the much more crazed launching of a large copper projectile at much higher speeds to try to excavate the subsurface. So after all of that babble and specificity, I will repeat, what are the Hayabusa 2 5-gram bullets made of? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
They're not made of Cheerios, are they?
Dang it, now I need a new contest.
You have until March 13, that'd be Wednesday, March 13 at 8 a.m. Pacific time, because we only care about where we live. And you could win yourself a Planetary Society kick asteroid, rubber asteroid, and a 200-point iTelescope.net account to do astronomy on that worldwide nonprofit network of telescopes. Take a look at Ceres. I'll bet you'll be able to pick it out. We're done.
All right, everybody. Go out there, look up the night sky, and think about your favorite cereal and what it would look like floating in space. Thank you and good night.
My favorite cereal or the ones I'm actually allow myself to eat now?
You're so disciplined.
They're magically delicious. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its planet-wide members. Mary Liz Bender is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan, Ad Astra.